Before we get into today's episode, it's Daniel here and we've got Lydia as well.
Hi.
And we've got some exciting news from Redchurch.
We do. So locally here at Redchurch in Melbourne, Australia, we are hiring.
Yeah, come on.
Yes, we have two new roles. First of all, a pastor of university students and an assistant pastor of university student outreach. We have been sensing for a long time that God is really moving and building a hunger in younger people. And we're seeing that particularly in the university space. And we've been asking, what would it look like for us to invest in this area? And God, if this is something that you want, you're going to have to make it possible.
Yeah.
So we've actually received partnership funding, which is allowing us to advertise and employ for these roles.
Yeah. So if you have a gift of evangelism and a real heart for this type of ministry or know someone who does, we would love to invite you to apply. You can head to redchurch.org.au/jobs to find out a bit more and how to apply.
We cannot wait to hear from you. Today on Rebuilders, we look at the tensions between generations and discuss who is the best generation.
No, not really. But we do look at this issue that seems to be eating up so much in our media space, social media, of boomers versus millennials, millennials versus Gen Z, and you know, peel behind it. What's going on, particularly around housing and the economy? So we deep dive into all of that, but push through the economic story that I tell, because at the end of it, in the second half, Trudy joins us and I think she has a really powerful, really prophetic insight into what God could actually be doing to unite the generations at the moment. At this moment of renewal, what if there's a parallel to what happened in the scriptures with Mary and Elizabeth and the carrying of the presence of God? I think this is a great episode.
It is. Let's get into it. Welcome to Rebuilders. My name is Lydia and I'm here with Mark and Daniel. How are you guys?
We are good. We are good.
Splendid.
The question is, how are you? You're getting married in 8 days.
Yeah. Yep. I am all right.
Ready to go. And it's going to be quite a Rebuilders themed wedding, as both Daniel and I are involved. I'm providing the sermon and Daniel has crafted an incredibly beautiful dance.
It's really special.
Oh, I actually didn't know about that until just now.
Yeah, you asked him to lead the ceremony and he's not going to use words. It's all interpretive dance.
Yeah. I know how creative you are and I just wanted to bring my bit of flair to it.
Yeah, yes. Thank you. Yeah. I'm actually walking down the aisle to the Rebuilders theme song. So,
great.
You know.
And Daniel has a Rebuilders themed leotard.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And it'll be live streamed. It'll be next week's episode.
It'll be a day to remember. Or forget.
No, looking forward to it, Lydia.
Yes, we're excited.
Yeah.
As am I. It'll be great. Should we get into today's episode?
Let's do it.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm now distracted by the whole leotard thing.
I know, I knew. I was waiting. But I had that on my sleeve ready to go.
Okay, I'll park that.
Yeah.
And we can discuss that later.
Put aside the mental imagery.
Yeah, bury it far away. Mm. So today we're talking about generations.
Yeah.
In particular, you know, if you've been on social media at all over the last couple of years, you'll know that there is this kind of dogged debate about who's better, boomers or millennials, or like who's responsible for ruining each other's lives. And I know I'm being a little bit dramatic right now, but there are these tensions that have surfaced more so in the last number of years that between generations, there is a kind of intergenerational warfare, as you kind of put it when we were discussing earlier. There's a cultural trend emerging, but you've got some perspective on that.
Yeah, I think it'd be good to talk about, because as you're right, and in a sense you're not being dramatic. A lot of the articles almost take that sort of tone of increasing tension, you know, and we've seen increasing tension in society and I think intergenerationally, you know, see polarization politically and, you know, all kinds of things going on. But I think, you know, this generational piece is growing in strength. And perhaps in the past, you know, we talked about intergenerational stuff in terms of fashion or music. But what you're seeing now is particularly around much more flashpoint issues. And I would say economically, is a really key one. Maybe sort of 10 years ago, there's a lot of people talking about the environment and, you know, people sort of saying what sort of world, you know, will future generations inhabit because of choices in the past. But I think that when I'm reading most of these sort of articles and particularly here in Australia, which I know is like many other places around the world, there's a housing crisis, which has now been met by a cost of living crisis. And just a real sense of anger and frustration over what will the future generations have economically. Yes. And the West is used to a story. It's the progress myth. And the progress myth says that over time, humans will perfect and we will get better and smarter and fairer and juster. Juster, is that a word?
More just.
And, you know, that also belief was that things will get economically better. And I think what we're seeing now is we're seeing a generation who is looking forward and they're seeing that they're probably not going to be as economically well off as the previous generations.
Sure.
And the baby boomer generation is a large generation in the world. They're called a baby boom because they were the generation that was born when many countries' soldiers and troops returned home and there was a big baby boom. Also, that period after World War II was in many countries a time of strong institutions, a time of consensus. There was a period of relative peace and a sort of, you know, economic equitability across the spectrum. And so, you know, it's a large and impactful generation. But I guess what I wanted to do is I wanted to sort of pop the bubble a little bit because as I read these articles, generational theory does not really explain what we're experiencing.
Sure.
It's not a generational story. It's actually an economic story. And so it's a historical and economic story. And so, you know, to do that, we've sort of got to go back a little bit and, you know, see some of the difficulties that the world began to sort of run into. I've talked about some of this before, but particularly that period from the end of World War II, really up until 1973 is the year that a lot of economists, I think Brad DeLong in his book Slouching Towards Utopia, which is an economic history, talks about 1973 being this year when that sort of golden period, as a lot of economists talk about. Now, we often look back to the past and, you know, people look back to that period and often will look at things around racism, around, you know, women's participation in society and see lots of things that people were doing wrong. But interestingly, economically, it was actually quite an equitable period. And the gap between the richest and the poorest people in a lot of Western countries was a lot more tighter than it is now. Inequality has grown. Oxfam released a report, I think it was last year, saying particularly since the pandemic, economic inequality has, you know, just growing, gaping, widening chasm in our society. So that particular period saw wages rising, but also productivity rising. And it was very much a sort of manufacturing-based economy. And that meant that people had access to things that their grandparents hadn't. A lot of those people's grandparents even, sorry, had actually lived through the Great Depression. And so the developed world really sort of grew and there was economic balance and there was also productivity, which meant rising living standards. But 1973, we hit a crisis. There's numbers of reasons for that. We have an oil shock as the Arab nations create an embargo over what? Israel and Palestine, sounds very familiar. And we also have, you know, industry starting to experience the fact that it's got competitors in places like Japan and so on. So the Western developed world economy starts to slow down. Now, productivity sort of continues in some way, but actually what happens is wages start to stagnate and you start to have this gap between what countries are producing and what individuals are experiencing. But productivity does sort of start to slow a bit. And what happens is the world starts to look for other ways to improve productivity, to give people a sense that they're actually being provided for. Now, the other issue is when you've got a big generation, so I said it's not generational. There is a generational component, but it's not in the way that we understand. So you've got the baby boomers. large generation, they tend to be their parents, the builders, as some call them, would tend to be more institutionally focused because they came through the Depression, they came through the two world wars, they saw the importance of collective action together and building strong institutions. But the boomers tend to be a bit more individualistic. Mm. And in the 1960s, very much there was the countercultural movement. They began to question a lot of went before. They went on a much more individualistic direction. And, you know, this meant that they had less children. So the next generation that came along, the Gen Xers, were actually a smaller generation. So this has created an imbalance because, in a sense, previously governments could provide things like pensions. And during that sort of just before the World War II and just after World War II, you see a lot of social welfare initiatives, mm-hmm. pensions, the dole, as we call it here in Australia, you know, like providing unemployment benefits. So the idea was that when you retired, you would be looked after.
Mm.
But the problem is when you've got a large generation, that's a large tax base that then goes to a smaller generation, that smaller generation is going to have to provide for more people than they're able to. So the tax base shrinks. So a number of things then happen. So one is that the economy moves in the West away from a manufacturing economy, much more into the drive of the economy is through financialization, which is borrowing money, betting on debt, it's really making money off money versus making money off things. A lot of industry goes offshore to places like China, especially in the developing world. And all of a sudden, this means that houses are important and buying houses are important, not because you want to live in that house necessarily. That's how it worked before.
Mm.
And in that post-war period, if you wanted to buy a home, it was often affordable. There were even like things the governments did around return servicemen and stuff like that that gave you grants. And they built houses. In Australia, they built houses for migrants and stuff like this. But what happens is you would want to borrow money and you would go to your local bank and you'd put on your best clothes because you wanted to you wanted to impress your local bank manager who you may have played golf with or you may get a church with or you may know from your local, I don't know, Lions Club or just from the local butcher. But what then happens after the 1970s as the world heads into this period of financialization is that all of a sudden that money that you borrow then becomes a source of productivity for big banks.
Yes.
So big banks make money not just from the money you borrow. So debt goes from something bad to something good. And the Western economy starts to be something that is driven by finance and making money off money, as I said, versus making money off things.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden then, houses and more importantly, the mortgages on houses mm-hmm. become a way to raise the productivity of the West. And what happens in this time is you see things like, say, big cities start to develop. So London, a lot of the money in Great Britain goes towards London because that's the hub of the financial mm-hmm. services. Hong Kong, you see this happen. So all of a sudden, then houses become something which can sort of juice the economy and it creates a bubble. Really, that's what we're in. We're in a housing bubble.
Mm.
Now, the other thing that happens as well is because governments might not be able to provide for people with their pension or superannuation or 401k, whatever you call it in your country, houses then are sold to people as a form of superannuation. Buy a house now, not just so you live in, but when you retire, you'll be looked after.
Mm.
So the baby boomers buy into this big time because that's literally what is and a lot of the policies encourage people towards that. So what happens is then you have the baby boomers buying up big, getting lots of houses. And in certain countries like our country, because that was a way of stimulating the economy, you had laws passed where people could own more than one house. So all of a sudden you have sort of this new economy where it's based on landlords, if that makes sense. So this begins to drive this bubble. One other thing, and apologies for getting bored by the economics here, but this is driving so much of our culture at the moment. Also, you have, you know, China, as I said, is building all of this stuff for people. All of a sudden, they got a lot of money. They have a lot of liquidity. There's lots of cash. You have places like Saudi Arabia, which is having an economic boom. So in the 1970s, you start to see Saudis buying up parts of London.
Mm.
You start to see in the 90s money coming from China as people don't necessarily trust their banks and their institutions.
Mm.
So they invest in real estate markets like Vancouver in Canada or in Australia. Also, Eastern Europe, communism falls and you start to see this move of money from places which formerly didn't have money into Western markets.
Yes.
Where do you put that? You put that in real estate.
Yeah.
So, is it all foreign liquidity? No, but is that a big part of this story? Absolutely. So we're now at the end of this model. It's not working. And what happens is you have a significant housing bubble where the next generation, because of this, the boomers in many ways just were simply doing what society encouraged them to do. But the problem is houses, particularly in cities, are so outpriced of young people because, you know, it's a bubble. That we now have this housing crisis.
Yes.
So really what this is not a generational issue. There are some generational dynamics, but ultimately what it is, it's an economic issue. So don't blame boomers, don't blame millennials. The model that the West has been running and the developed world has been running is coming into an economic crisis, and we're coming to the end of it's like if you had a vein of gold that you've been digging and your city becomes rich. Melbourne got rich in the 19th century because we found gold in central Victoria. But there's a point where oil wells, veins of gold run out. Yes. In some ways, that's where we're at now.
Yeah.
So we're in this strange thing where housing prices is going up, but there's inaffordability, and this is going to come to a crisis. Governments do not have the political will to move on this, and it is a crisis. And the next thing, it's interesting in Canada, you're seeing some of this. The next wave of populism, whether it's left or right, is going to be around housing. And you're going to see it start to switch from, I think, identity issues to housing affordability. And it's literally a race who can get there fast enough. So this will become more pressing. And I think we're going to see a political crisis that's born out of an economic crisis in the next 5 to 10 years in many countries around the world. I think we're seeing the beginning of it.
So to kind of summarize your point, which you kind of did there at the end, this is all what we're tying to generations is actually something that the generations aren't personally responsible for. It is the nature of what's happened in the economy, particularly in the West.
Yes.
So what I'm hearing is that there's this intersection between what we've believed about generational theory and what's happening in the economy. So where does generational theory come from?
Yes.
And how can we understand that so that we can separate it and tease it out a little bit from this economic stuff?
Yeah. Okay. So generational theory is one way of understanding the moves of history. Obviously, history moves in this sort of patterns that we see. Mark Twain said, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. And so we can't help looking at different periods in, you know, like there's lots of books at the moment that people are, there's the meme about, you know, men thinking about the Roman Empire. And a lot of that is actually really about the fall of the Roman Empire. So people look at something like the end of the Roman Empire and then they wonder like, you know, could that be happening now to the West? And that's interesting because the West very much based its identity on rediscovering the classical culture of the Greco-Roman world. Edward Gibbon, who wrote the Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, you know, sort of he was part of the Enlightenment, and they looked at history differently. Up to that point, history had been looked at as something which, you know, was the story of the church. You know, history in the West was divided between, you know, BC and AD because of the birth of Christ. But in the Enlightenment period, that began to be seen differently. And they looked back before the rise of Christianity, back to the Greco-Roman world as the exemplar. And so Gibbon then, you know, and people like this, they write in the sort of, you know, 16th and 17th centuries about, well, sorry, 17th, 18th century about, you know, really, the rise of Christianity was the rise of superstition. And there's these, you know, they'd walk around Europe at that time and see these Roman columns and you know, Roman baths and wonder what happened to this once great culture. So this concept of decline very much then came into people's heads. How does this happen? So, you know, that idea, if you see the founding of the American Republic, some of the political ideas that they're bringing together, obviously British political thought, particularly the sort of more Whiggish, liberal sort of thought. They're seeing some of the French Republican thought. And when you have the revolution in France and revolution in America, they look back to almost, they're reestablishing these kinds of republics. And interestingly, generational theory then becomes one way of explaining why do great civilizations fail.
Mm.
Now, you can go right back to Ibn Khaldun. I think we've talked about this before, you know, who's an Arabic, you know, sort of father of sociology, you know, and he talked about, you know, you've got these different generations where the first generation was one who might be pioneers and sort of scratch out, you know, a society on the edge of a desert somewhere. They ram into their kids the need for the values of why that society was created. So the kids get to live in a better society. The third generation then receive that as our memory because things are comfortable. And the fourth generation sort of throws it away. And that's when decline is possible.
Yeah.
Now, very much generational theory begins in the United States, and probably the people that we have to thank it for the most, or, you know, the sort of main contributors are Strass and Howe. Mm-hmm. And they came up with, they wrote a book called Generations, and they sort of went all the way back to the founding of the American Republic and the 13 colonies or whatever it is, the founding fathers, and then sort of followed different generations. So in some ways, what they're doing is they're bringing the sort of Ibn Khaldun theory to America. And, you know, they're very much behind concepts like the baby boomers and millennials. I think they call them the baby bust. They call them, like, and they see this cycle effectively. Sure. So they see it very similar to a sort of Khaldun cycle. It begins with this very much this high point of consensus, strong institutions, individuality is not central. And then they sort of see there's often then an inner turning where it moves from the institution to the individual. Often that sort of generation rebels against the previous generation. But this means that the institutions are weakened and there's no coherence, and then an unraveling happens. And the unraveling then leads to the sort of fourth stage, which is a crisis. And very much they see the crisis then has the potential for the birth of another great generation, you know. So in many ways, this sort of follows, you know, the question the founding fathers had early on, is this idea that they've come up with going to continue?
Yes.
There's an interesting book, I can't remember it, but it's sort of like the fact that a lot of the founding fathers near the end of their lives were actually thought what they had originally come up with was going wrong. So I think in the American understanding of how a nation is birthed is very different to other cultures. I think in Australia, we almost have a sort of an anti-historical viewpoint sometimes. But other countries would have a very long, like, you know, if you're in Scandinavia, you're thinking all the way back to the Vikings or something, this long arc of history, where the US sees that it's born from this crisis, the Revolutionary War, and then this great generation emerges of the founding fathers, and that sort of births America. So I think this story has been very, attractive to a lot of American thinkers. Interestingly, I've noticed people outside of America talk about generations. They might talk about baby boomers or millennials or Gen Z, but they don't talk about the big arc stuff as much of the cycles because perhaps it doesn't apply to us, or it's not as attractive because we don't have that founding father generation, if that makes sense. And Strass and Howe wrote also a book called, I think in 1987, they wrote The Fourth Turning, which is this sort of this idea that of those sort of sacralum or whatever they call it, these cycles of history. And they posited that the millennials were going to be that great generation.
Yeah, okay.
And that they would sort of reach this crisis, and then they obviously had to walk that back a bit.
Yeah, sorry, Gus.
Sorry, that wasn't a dig on millennials, but, you know, what they sort of predicted hasn't happened. But, you know, it's very much picked up, you know, by different people. Everyone from Al Gore to Steve Bannon, you know, is very much on board with this. And so I think that what that has meant that we tend to then look through historical patterns, and we look at, say, something we're experiencing now. It very much feels like there's a crisis in the world. And I think, like, how I see it is, I think some of the generational theory stuff is quite interesting. If you go all the way back to Ibn Khaldun, I think there is a truth. You see this. You see this in the migrant family who comes out, works really hard. The kids then sort of establish that, and then often you'll see a third or fourth generation sort of throw it away, you know, because they, you know. So I think there's truth there, and I think that there is sort of generations that rise out of crises that birth something, and so on. Is it always as neat as that? I'm a bit skeptical, you know, and I think that sort of monocausal explanations for historical patterns where you just look at the one thing.
Yes.
So I would say generational theory is part of it. Is it everything? No.
Yeah.
What I've added, the economic story here, you could possibly write that over some of the generational stuff, but I think the problem is some of the media commentary on it. And look, Strassenhaus' theory is much more complex than this, so I don't want to write them off. But I almost feel like so often what happens is people take a theory, they then write an article. They haven't even read the book themselves. They've heard someone talk about the book and then they write an article in the sort of tabloid news that captures this. I think that when we just talk about it through boomers versus millennials, I think it's increasingly you're going to have a conversation between millennials and Gen Z. You're seeing that naturally generations define themselves against the generation previous. That's, I think, part of the youth culture that emerges post-World War II.
Yeah.
But it's unhelpful when we use it to try and capture complex economic and social issues like we're experiencing.
Mm.
But it could be a very powerful political weapon.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that you could see a millennial populist rise who finds a political consensus which unites generations, emerging generations, against an older generation who are losing power.
Yeah.
So the reason that this stuff goes is, yes, it sells tabloid news articles. Yes, it's an easy way online to blame people for the reason your life isn't what you thought it could be. Yeah. But I think we will see it be a political tool used in the future as the new political mood is no longer consensus. We're all together. It's us versus them.
Yes.
And perhaps it's a more powerful one than just doing it around race or gender or whatever, in that you can get a bigger cohort of people. Mm. But unhelpful. And I think from a Christian perspective, not helpful either.
Yeah. Well, as always, on Rebuilders, we attempt to look at culture and then zoom out and understand it from a biblical perspective. So we're going to take a little break now and we're going to have Trudy join us. Trudy Sayers, your wife, who is going to share some more of the spiritual insight to what generations or how God can use generations.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're back and we're joined by Trudy. Welcome back, Trudy.
Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
No worries. Thanks for joining us. We just finished up the first part of the podcast where we were exploring how generational theory and what's happening in the economy aren't necessarily as intrinsically linked as the media and cultural trends would have us believe. Mm. So teasing that out. And then we kind of suggested that we're going to head in a bit of a spiritual direction, looking at how God uses the generations and how we can see this throughout the Bible and in one particular area.
Mm.
Mark, you thought Trudy would be a great person to have on to explore this. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, Trudy shared with me a sort of prophetic sense she'd had reading scripture, particularly the story of the Nativity. And there's an interesting part of that, which she'll bring up in a moment, but she then preached on this and I just felt that this speaks into this generational dynamic. And I think it actually brings a sort of healing, helpful metaphor. It's not only aspirational in that it's something we should head towards, but I think it's also something that actually explains and gives voice to something that's currently happening positively between the generations as God brings renewal. So I thought it'd be great to bring her on, get her to share what she's been sensing from the Lord around this issue of generations.
Well, Trudy, do you maybe want to just give us a bit of a broad brushstrokes of what it is that God sort of laid on your heart as you were reading the Nativity story?
Yeah, for sure. as many of us do, we tend to read this story every Christmas time in Advent. And but last year as I was reading it, the Lord highlighted something I hadn't really paid a lot of attention to before, and that was that it's actually really significant that both Mary and Elizabeth were pregnant at the same time.
Mm.
That Mary being so young, and of course Elizabeth so old in her older years, and there was something really significant and beautiful about the way the interaction between these two women. Mm. And so I've spent some more time over the last few months. It keeps coming up a few in different ways, but just to meditate on the significance of this and how they particularly supported and mentored and encouraged one another.
Mm. So what elements of the story resonated with you, and what do you feel it's saying to us today?
Yeah. So first of all, I've looked at some of the similarities between their pregnancies and considering and what they both carry in common, and then what are the unique callings and roles in their the way that they're young and old. So I guess to consider, first of all, what the things that they had in common were that both women were of faith, have faith, and they were both humble. Mm. And this played out, of course, in different ways in the story. But for Mary, having faith in her situation actually was very costly and risked shame in her carrying the pregnancy. For Elizabeth, her faith came from in her older years, the waiting, her faith in the long wait and the barrenness of her years.
Mm.
So there was something unique in that. So they both had faith, they were both humble, and they recognised each other's faith and actually encouraged each other's faith.
Mm.
They also had in common that both their pregnancies were very vulnerable and involved a posture of weakness and dependency. So the fact that they were both vulnerable meant they also benefited from that mutual encouragement and support. So
we've been talking here about generations and how there's increasingly generational warfare that's encouraged by the media. It's definitely felt amongst people, millennials versus boomers. Boomers are older. Millennials are young, well, not as young as they used to be, but they're still young. And, you know, you've got Gen Z coming up. What do you think, how does this picture of, you know, Mary and Elizabeth speak into that dynamic? And what positive story does it have to tell?
So what I'm seeing now is I am actually seeing the old and young participating in the new thing that God is doing. I'm seeing the older generation passionate about prayer, and as we hear of, the spot fires we've been talking about and kind of, moments of renewal that we're seeing breaking out, we're seeing the older generation like weeping. I'm hearing stories of them just move to emotion and going, like saying things like, I've longed for this for many years. And I thought of Elizabeth, like in the joy that she felt as she'd been waiting for so long and just her joy. That there's a unique joy that comes in the waiting and the sowing. And so I'm seeing that in the older generation. I'm seeing, we're seeing the older generation shepherd and encourage the younger generation as well. We've talked about what happened at Asbury, but there were the older generation also praying and sowing into what was happening and encouraging and mentoring and supporting the younger generation. So,
I just was going to say, I think I was thinking of something you said the other day, Daniel. We had on Maundy Thursday, we had a sort of, really prayer and sort of worship night with some other churches here in Melbourne. And yeah, you said something interesting about what you noticed about the older generation in the room, because it's not necessarily the whole of a generation, is it? It's people in a generation. Yeah, what were you sharing there?
Oh, it was just there was a beautiful moment just observing multiple old and young worshiping together. And there's just this real, some of the older generation in there, I'm talking kind of 70, 80 plus kind of thing. There was just a real kind of joy to their worship and this sense of, like, I'm guessing a lot of them have been praying for this kind of unity, this kind of crying, seeking God's heart for 50 years.
Yes, yes.
Like there's this, and they're actually beginning to experience that now. And there was just something as a younger millennial, like, just like, oh my goodness, oh, what a rich kind of, I don't know, heritage I'm stepping into, I suppose, knowing that there's been generations that have been praying this in for a long time before I've got here.
Kind of on that, the Lord also like revealed something to, highlighted something else in the story, that actually Elizabeth's pregnancy was actually carrying a child that she potentially wouldn't raise in her older years. And I think that there's something significant about kind of praying and sowing for the next generation. So that is kind of like a unique call and posting for the older generation. Perhaps you're contending for something beyond your lifetime.
Yes. Mm. Yeah, you're really investing important. In something that you're not necessarily going to see come to fruition.
And I wonder if there's something prophetic in that. I mean, we did talk about how in many ways the baby boomers were that post-war generation, but it was in some ways the first individualistic generation. It was the first youth culture generation. And I think the Who sang, you know, "Hope I Die Before I Get Old," you know, and you had all these sort of, you know, icons of the 60s who died before 30. But it's an interesting thing, isn't it? Like, what if the prophetic thing is, well, it's not about you, but now it's about stewarding, passing something on that you may not see. I think there's something deeply prophetic about that. What did you see, Trude, in terms of the young? You know, Mary, what are you seeing in the young at the moment?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, we think of Mary and she's humble, she's faithful. She's also carrying a very costly pregnancy, isn't she? And she's obedient. And I think what we're seeing is in the young, we're seeing a new spiritual hunger.
Yes.
But, you know, we're seeing there's this hiddenness and humility in the young that are carrying the new thing God's doing. There's a call for consecration and obedience. And I think there is a potential that the young are also called to be, just as the old are called to be forerunners, that the young are called to be forerunners perhaps in their generation as well. And that will be costly. So there is an element of cost.
And shame.
And even. Shame, potentially. Yeah. Like, because to stand up for truth and righteousness in this generation is costly. I think, but I actually think there's just such a, this story just models such a beautiful example of yeah, as I said, mutual encouragement and support. And I think there is a call in this hour for spiritual mothers and fathers to rise up and really champion and cheer on the next generation and mentor and so that it's not just a kind of a short-term renewal. It's actually like encouraging, just as we, you know, those people that have prayed for many years, they've had that kind of long-haul obedience and zeal. We need mentors to help young people carry it for the long term. And I think, you know, to really steward what they're carrying as well, and to have that generational lens.
And that's helpful, isn't it? Because I think often one of the mistakes that we've made when it comes to generational theory, and maybe this is one critique of perhaps even some of the sort of Strauss and Howe view, it's like there'll be an entire generation which leads us back to some better time after the crisis, you know. And there may be some truths where you have, you know, defining characteristics of generations. But I think this biblical view is it's not every young woman at that time in Israel is going to be it. It's Mary. And it's not every older person. It's Elizabeth. And I think that that framework of humility and faith is really what defines. So in a sense, whilst Mary and Elizabeth are age is so different, their life experience is so different, their situations are so different. They're united generationally, because in a sense the Bible talks about the generations, all the people in the world at that moment, that they're united by that faithfulness and that hiddenness and that humbleness is really, really key. So it's not going to be like Gen, because often you hear this, like you heard this about millennials, you know, millennials is going to be this thing, or Gen Z is going to be this thing. No, it's not. There's going to be plenty of Gen X's, Gen Z boomers, millennials who are absolute drongos, to use an Australian term there. It's the humble, the hidden, the faithful.
And I think also just on that, it's the humble, hidden and faithful in the way that they carry the gift that God has given them. Because both of them are carrying pregnancies that were, you know, seemingly impossible or and quite fraught at the time. So their humility and faithfulness and everything in carrying that and stewarding that, that's the kingdom.
And because they're also carrying the presence too. That's what I keep thinking about. It's they both are hosting, like in a sense, they're carrying the next thing that God's doing. Well, Mary is really carrying the presence of God. You know, Elizabeth's carrying the forerunner. Did you have any thoughts on that, carrying the presence? Did that sort of come through in your reflections of what does it mean to sort of host? Because there's some, I think you were telling me some of the stuff around the tabernacle or the ark, you know.
Because Mary, of course, is like the ark, isn't she? She's carrying the presence, and like, there's even something significant about Mary staying with Elizabeth for 3 months, and how that would have blessed the household.
Elizabeth came.
I think there's also something significant when you think about pregnancy and the perhaps. Like a pregnancy being preparation. And so I think that speaks to our current moment in that there's the early signs, but there's actually more to carry and tarry and contend for in the both the old and the young. So I think that is in itself speaks to our current our moment, I think.
That's true, isn't it? Because pregnancy is different, isn't it? Like it's not normal. There's cravings, your body changes, your patterns change, you know, and you have to do pregnancy different to what you do.
Do normal life.
Yeah. And if we're in a pregnant moment, we have to do it differently.
So I think pregnancy, like, you know, you have 9 months to prepare. And so I think pregnancy is the moment of preparation. So like we're seeing first signs. And I think, but there's kind of more to come that we actually are contending for. So I think there's that invitation in this moment for those who will carry God's new thing.
And maybe this is something that can wrap up our time. It just came to me as you were speaking that, you know, one of the things is that, you know, we talked about at the very beginning, the sort of generational conflict over the wealth that boomers are carrying. And that will be handed over to the next generation at some stage. But really what we're talking about here is the sort of wealth of faith being handed down, you know, and a generational transfer of passion for God, the Holy Spirit, we're at that moment, and how well are we going to do that? You know, how well are we going to hand down that inheritance, you know, which we've received of faith, which feels like a very strategic moment.
Yeah. Well, what an encouragement to have you on, Trudy. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and reflections and, what God has been prompting you in. That brings us to the end of our episode. Thank you for joining us. If you want to get a list of any of the books that we've mentioned during the episode and a little bit of a conversation where we debrief some of the thoughts that we've had, you can subscribe to our mailing list if you're not already subscribed by heading to rebuilders.co and signing up there. And we send out an email a couple of days after our episode is released. But that brings us to the end for today. Thanks for joining us.
Farewell.